This is Vicki Wicks, and today I'm talking to Tom Oliver, who's going to tell me about the experiences that he had in World War II, and particularly in being shot down over Yugoslavia. Welcome, Tom, and thank you very much for talking to us.
My name is Tom Oliver, or Thomas K. Oliver, if you want to be formal. I graduated from West Point on the 1st of June, 1943, with a set of pilot's wings, and then learned to fly a B-24. I spent the rest of 1943 learning to fly a B-24, getting my crew and doing all sorts of training, dropping practice bombs, etc., with my crew. 1st of January, 1944, we had a new airplane, new B-24, issued to us. We named it the Fighting Mudcat because the old Mudcat, this is before you had catfish from fish farms, the old Mudcat was a survivor. So we thought that would be a good name. Well, we flew overseas the South Atlantic route down to Natal, Brazil, crossed the South Atlantic over to Dakar in Africa. From Dakar, we flew across the Sahara Desert, went over the Atlas Mountains and let down into Marrakech, spent a night there, went on to Tunisia. In Tunisia, the whole group got together again, and together in formation, we flew over to Italy. I was flying combat missions in March and April of 1944, and my crew and I had finished about half of our mission, so we figured we were veterans. 6th of May, we got assigned a mission to the oil fields at Ploesti. That was a very tough mission. I was breaking in a new co-pilot on this mission. Our group had a policy of we broke up a new crew and let each man fly within one mission with an experienced crew before they got together and flew together themselves. So I was breaking in a new co-pilot. Well, our group led the 15th Air Force over Ploesti. That's not the most comfortable position to be in because the fighter pilots and the anti-aircraft gunners, they're not tired a bit. They're all just itching to get at you. And they did. We had heavy anti-aircraft fire and lots of fighters. One German fighter, an FW-190, came right at our airplane nose on. Up in front, you see flames coming from the leading edge of his wing, and unfortunately, you know just what that means. He ducked down and went just underneath our airplane. Our gunners say he went down trailing smoke. We'll never know whether we really hit him fatally or not. And we don't know whether it was the German fighter or the anti-aircraft that damaged our airplane. Shortly after bombs away, we saw that number three engine, that's to the right of the co-pilot, was losing oil pressure. We tried to feather it. It wouldn't feather. We looked out the window and could see why. The prop governor was hanging by one bolt. Well, we had great drag and vibration. I had to slow down. I couldn't keep up with the group. That makes you very nervous because the German fighters like to pick on anybody that was out of formation. A couple of P-38s came down and flew, one on my right and one on my left, and I would like to have hugged those P-38 pilots. I'll probably never know exactly who they were. After a while, they waggled their wings and went off. They couldn't afford to go home as slow as I was flying, but they had protected me as long as I was in danger from German fighters. Well, after a while, number three engine started to seize up from windmilling around with no oil in it. And that was exciting. very rough vibration. If you looked at the right wing of the airplane, it looked as though you tied one end of a rope to a tree and went and jiggled the other end. And you saw sine waves going up and down the length of that wing. I was hoping the wing would not break off, and fortunately it didn't. Finally, there was a big bang, and the prop spun free on its own bearing. Apparently, the reduction gear, which fastens the prop to the engine, had failed, so the prop is just spinning free on its own bearing. And that made things go a little quieter for a while, but not for long. Then number four engine, that's the farthest on the right-hand side, started losing its oil pressure. Well, we quick got that one feathered. So, and we threw out flak vests, guns, anything, ammunition, anything we could throw out to lighten the airplane. We were managing to hold 145 miles an hour and 8,000 feet of altitude with two engines dead on one side. And I was thinking, oh boy, when I get this thing back to Italy, I ought to get what? Maybe a Distinguished Flying Cross for getting it back to Italy with two engines dead on one side. More important than that, I'd be a big man on campus. People would say, there goes Oliver. He must be a great pilot. Well, it didn't work out. We crossed the Danube River, about where there's a three-way boundary, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania. And shortly after that, we ran into a flak battery at Bor, Yugoslavia. We're down at 8,000 feet, and that flak battery had us dead to rights. My navigator had been doing a good job of steering us away from any known flak batteries. Unfortunately, this flak battery was not known, so he had no way of knowing it was there. Well, I don't know if it was the first or the second burst from that flak battery. It went off right underneath the airplane, set number two engine on fire. That's the one to the left of the pilot. And the crew all said the bomb doors looked like the top of a salt shaker. Fortunately, and miraculously, no one of us got hit. Well, at that point, you don't scratch your head wondering what to do. You know what to do. I hit the bailout bell. I said, bailout, bailout, very urgently on the interphone. And took another look at the burning engine. Didn't look a darn bit better. Turned around to see how they were doing at getting out. It seemed like everybody was gone except for the navigator. He was on the Bombay catwalk motioning me for to get out of the airplane. Well, I motioned him to get out because I didn't want anybody in my way when I let go of the wheel and headed for the Bombays to jump out of the airplane. Well, he bailed out, and then I bailed out, and I thought to myself as I tumbled through the air, you know, even if the chute does not open, I'm not any worse off than I was in that airplane. Well, it did open, fortunately. For a while, I'm going down very slow, and I think, gee, the Germans will have plenty of time to get a patrol and pick me up the minute I hit the ground. Later on, it seemed I was approaching the ground awfully fast. Somewhere in the middle of this descent, I heard a siren, the loudest siren I have ever heard in my life to this day. And apparently it was the free prop on that airplane winding up. I don't know why it didn't fly apart, but it didn't. The loudest siren I have ever heard. Well, that drew my attention to the airplane, which was diving into the ground. It hit the ground. There was a big fireball. Cecil B. DeMille never did anything more spectacular. And after the fire died out, there was a big black spot on the ground. I was glad I wasn't part of the black spot. Okay, I Landed, thought I made a fairly good landing. I took up the shock in my knees, rolled forward onto a shoulder. And in spite of that, I had one very sore shin for a week or so. Yugoslav peasants quickly came about me. One of them wanted my parachute, and I was very glad to get rid of it, so I motioned he could have it. They took me up to where they were having a picnic lunch, an outdoor table, wooden table. There was a sheep's head sitting on the table. I think most of the food had been eaten already, but there was this sheep's head, eyeballs and all, and they offered me the eyeballs. I'm sure that to the local Yugoslavians, that's the best part. But I politely declined, with gestures, of course. Then they offered me a glass of wine. I thought that was a marvelous idea. I drank that. Must not have been 10 minutes before a couple of men came up. They were wearing little military caps, military jackets. Each had a rifle slung over his shoulder. They were leading a small horse, and they said, Draža Mihailovich. I recognized that as the name of the local guerrilla leader, and they indicated I should get on the horse. Well, it seemed like a good idea to me since I had that sore shin, so I got on the horse and we started moving. A couple of times I heard shots fired over the hill. I really don't know how close any German pursuit, if there was any, would have been. One time we came across a local Yugoslavian doctor who apparently had been educated in France, and we sort of conversed in French. He was very helpful. He would put the words into my mouth. He would say, is it that you are concerned about your comrades from the airplane? And I said, oui. And he said they were all okay, except one was slightly wounded. So that was reassuring. That evening we wind up at a peasant farmhouse, and the lady of the house offered me a hot cup of hot goat's milk with a kind of scum all over it. Well, by that time I was pretty hungry, and I thought, well, these people drink this and it doesn't seem to hurt them any. They're pretty robust. So I downed the hot goat's milk, and you know, once I got used to the idea, it tasted pretty good. I think I probably got something else to eat. I forget just what. They put me to bed on a pile of straw, and somewhere in the wee small hours they woke me up. It was time to move again. This time we had about six of the Chetnik guerrilla fighters. There were, and each of us had a horse. There were three of them ahead of me, single file, winding through the hills, and then three behind me. And, oh, they tended to wear Cossack-style fur hats. Each has a rifle slung over his shoulder, little tight military-looking jackets. About all you hear is the jingling of the horse's harness. The only light is the moonlight. I kind of pinched myself and I said, what am I doing here in the middle of a black and white Class B movie? But there I was. Well, the next morning we wound up in a little village, and I guess by this time they felt we were in pretty safe territory. We kind of went from one outdoor bistro to the next, and at each one they served a round of drinks. And I thought, this is my kind of war. I carried two knives. One was a hunting knife on my belt, and another was a trench knife that I wore strapped to my leg. And one of them asked me, of course, all of this is with gestures. We still don't have an interpreter or any common language. One of them asked me, why did I have two knives? I was kind of at a loss for an answer, but one of the other Chetniks served, gave the answer. He said one knife was a Hitler, and he made a gurgling sound and a throat-cutting gesture, and the other, a Mussolini, and the same throat-cutting gesture. Well, that seemed like a good answer, and I used it on various occasions later on. Always seemed to work very well. That night, we came to a little village, and they had a religious ceremony that was very interesting. They took me to the graves of a couple of American airmen who had been shot down and killed. Very nicely tended graves. There were probably a dozen of the Yugoslav men there and the local Serbian Orthodox priest. And they had a ceremony. It was must have been a sort of requiem mass for the dead. In the process, they passed around a cup of wine, and each man took a little sip and deliberately spilled a little bit on the grave. Kind of a touching ceremony, bringing the deceased into the ceremony. That night, they put me to bed in a nice little house in the village, and wee small hours, once again, I got waked up, and they said, Heidi, Heidi, Heidi Brisso. And I had learned by then that meant move out, move quick. And they took me out into the woods in my underwear. There had been a scare that Germans might be approaching. Well, after a while, the scare was over and finished the night in the village. Next day, at the end of the day, I got together with the rest of my crew for the first time. We were in a peasant farmhouse. They had gathered probably about 24 of us there. There was most of a B-17 crew and some odds and ends of Americans who had been shot down. Here we had an interpreter. He was an older man who had been in the United States for a few years when he was much younger. Apparently he had worked in the lumbering business up in Wisconsin along with the Swedes. It was very unusual. He talked English with an accent like, my name is Jan Janssen, I come from Wisconsin, which is most unusual for a Yugoslav. Well, we were there for about a month. Whittling out corn cob pipes and doing whatever we could think of to pass the time. We met in the village at the local Chetnik commander, who was a man named Kent. He was a very dynamic, energetic, robust person. You could see why he was the leader of the guerrillas. The members of my crew signed a dollar bill for him and handed it to him as a memento. And it's interesting, I have to this day, by a various circuitous route, I have a Xerox copy of that dollar bill. It was apparently very important to Kent because I think he got out of Yugoslavia with what he was carrying on his back. So far as I know, he is still alive and well in Geneva, Switzerland. Well, after about a month, we managed to convince the local people that we should move on, and we were assigned an interpreter and a guide. He was a Captain Ivan Miloch. He had learned English largely by listening to the radio, and he ushered us about 150 kilometers westward across Yugoslavia to the heart of old Serbia and the region, general region where Mihailovic's headquarters was. Oh, on that trek, I remember a lot of walking. I remember sleeping in haystacks, sleeping on hard schoolhouse floors. Nothing is harder than a schoolhouse floor to sleep on. Eventually, we got to the region of Mihailovic's headquarters, and we were split up. They'd put two, three, four people at one peasant farmhouse, and gradually the numbers of Americans there in the vicinity increased. We would hear the 15th Air Force going overhead. First, we'd hear a faint sound and we'd wonder, now, is that really it? But it would get louder and louder and louder till it was a roar, and you'd see all the B-24s going overhead in good formation. Nobody will ever see that sight again. And sometime later, they'd come back in a more ragged formation. Of course, they'd been to Ploesti. And after they came back, we could kind of figure there'd be another two or three B-24 crews join us on the ground in Yugoslavia. Got to where we had about 150 Americans there on the ground in Yugoslavia. Now, we weren't all in one group at one spot, you know. We were spread around, as I said, two or three or four in different peasant farmhouses. I started going around with a fighter pilot, Jack Barrett, who somehow he and I just got along very well. He had been a P-47 pilot, and he wasn't shot down. His engine quit over Yugoslavia. So there he was. Well, as time went on, the Yugoslavs, well, ones that could speak English, would tell us, well, we have notified our government in Cairo, and they have notified the British that how many of you are here. And you just have to be patient. Sometime they'll do something about an evacuation. Well, Jack Barrett and I, after a while, you know, we've got weeks to think this over. We'd probably been in Yugoslavia for a full 2 months before we started thinking of this. We thought, you know, what we need to do is get word to the Americans over in Italy, the 15th Air Force, how many of us are here. They're going to be more interested in running an evacuation than the British down in Cairo are. So, we discovered that to get access to the local radio transmitter, we needed General Mihailovich's permission. Well, I was a first lieutenant, 21 years old. And in order to get to see General Mihailovich, I said to the locals, hey, as far as I know, I'm the ranking officer among the Americans here. I want to see the boss of the Chetniks. I want to see General Mihailovich. Well, that seemed to work fine. They ushered Jack Barrett and myself to see General Mihailovich. We spoke through an interpreter. And we said we wanted to send this message to Italy and we wanted to use his radio transmitter. And he said he wanted to assure us they had notified their government in Cairo, etc., etc. But to make doubly sure, he would back our sending the message. Well, now it seemed that many of the Americans said, oh no, don't send any message, the Germans will intercepted and home in on the transmitter and capture us all. Well, Jack Barrett and I figured, you know, the Germans are getting beat in France. We heard something about what was happening there via Radio London, radio broadcasts, and they're getting beat over in Russia. We don't think they have their best crack troops in Yugoslavia. We don't think the people there are all that anxious to come in here and fight the guerrillas in order to capture us. But in order to appease the people that said don't send any message at all, and for some other reasons too, Jack Barrett and I figured out a little short message using a lot of American slang. We said, Mudcat driver to COAPO 520. Well, My usual airplane was the Fighting Mudcat, so I was the Mudcat driver. The CO of APO 520 is the commanding officer of the 15th Air Force. We said 150 Yanks are in Yugo, some sick. And we said, shoot us workhorses. Well, the workhorse of the American Air Force was the C-47, so that's what we meant for them to send us. We thought if the Germans intercept the message, shoot us workhorses, they might think of dragging old Dobbin out and shooting him. I don't know. I don't know if the Germans ever did intercept the message, and if so, whether they ever made head or tail of it. Well, we went on to give a challenge and an authenticator, and we made, these are light signals you use. One person flashes the challenge letter and the other party flashes the authenticator letter, and then you know you're dealing with the right party. And we signed it, I signed it flat rat four in the lug order. Well, our group commander had signed on the wall of the officers' club, all the lugs in the 459th group sign here, Marden M. Munn, chief lug. And I had signed it, T.K. Oliver, flat rat four in the lug order. Our tent was named Poker Flat, and so we signed it as flat rats. So, well, this served a purpose. When it finally got to the right place, it convinced the Americans that we were for real, because nobody else would have known all those little details. We said they had to refer it to the Shark Squadron of the 459th Group for decoding. Our squadron had shark mouths painted on our B-24s, believe it or not. So we were the Shark Squadron. Well, we, Jack Barrett and I, took a couple of radio operators. We were escorted to General Mihailovich's radio transmitter. There was a local Chetnik operator. We took a couple of radio operators with us in case it was needed, but here's this Chetnik operator. He knows his equipment. He's expert at using it. He doesn't know a word of English, but that doesn't matter. He's translating a message in Morse code, letter by letter, and we had the message spelled out on a scrap of paper. So he sent the message. Of course, you know, we had no guarantee anybody in Italy was going to pick it up or was going to do anything with it if they did, because this man has no set schedule for communicating with Italy. Fortunately, the message was picked up by a Royal Air Force signal squadron, and they, incidentally, not so long ago, I heard from the head of that signal squadron. They said that when they got this weird message, they thought it had obviously been sent by somebody who had been overseas for too long. But they had sense enough to send it to 15th Air Force headquarters, and it filtered down to my squadron, where they were able to decode it. They recognized that it was I who had sent it. And so that set the ball rolling for getting us out of there. Somebody in 15th Air Force headquarters had a brilliant idea. They said, send us your longitude and latitude and encode them by adding the longitude and latitude to the serial number of your radio operator, Sullivan. So we did that. And in a similar code, they told us exactly when they were going to drop in an OSS team. One night around midnight, we saw the marvelous profile of a C-47 up overhead, and three parachutes dropped out of it, and this was the OSS team that was going to arrange the evacuation. George Musselin was the head of it. He spoke Serbian very well. They had a radio operator and another man who spoke Serbian. They also dropped with them code books and radio equipment, so they were all set to communicate with Italy and arrange the evacuation. Well, within a week or 10 days, the evacuation was on. The local peasant fixed up an airstrip. They'd fill up holes by putting in rocks and dirt and cover it over with sod. The strip was sort of along the brow of a hill, long, narrow, and off the end, you're just kind of dropped off into the valley. It would have been like landing or taking off from a carrier. Well, around midnight, C-47 started coming in one at a time. First one came, landed, took off again before the second one landed. We figured sick and wounded should go out first, and they did. And after that, it was whoever was in Yugoslavia the longest went out the first. Using that rule, I was on the third airplane to go out. They flew us back to Bari, Italy. Incidentally, when we got on the airplanes, most of us took our shoes off and threw them out the door. We knew that the local peasants were extremely short of shoes. And we thought, well, we won't need them anymore. And it turned out we didn't. We got back to Italy. They took all our clothes and burned them to kill the fleas and the lice, gave us showers, issued us new khakis. And we were set to take the next transport back to the United States. My whole crew got back safely, got back to the United States safely. I take some small amount of satisfaction in that fact. I could throw in one postscript. Our tail gunner, Smitty, hit his head getting out of the airplane, and he was in and out of conscious. He had sense enough to pull his ripcord, woke up lying on the ground. He used to complain he had a sore neck, and we would say, well, Smitty, have another drink of brachia. It's the local potent plum brandy. Wasn't much else we could do for him. He later wrote me that on his mustering out physical, they x-rayed his neck and discovered he had a cracked vertebrae in his neck from his bailing out of the airplane. Just as well we did not know it at the time. So that about ends my tale. Any questions?
We were talking before that your father was a general in World War II.
Yes, he was a major general. He commanded the 5th Armored Division. At the close of the war, they were right on the Elbe River, about as close to Berlin as any American troops were.
When you were in Yugoslavia, your mother got a telegram?
Oh, yes, my mother got my missing in action telegram. And she got a hold of my father, who was still in England at that time. This is, you know, I'm shot down a month before D-Day. He was in England with the 5th Armored Division waiting for D-Day. He made inquiries, and he got the best information they had, which was that my airplane had gone down over the target in Romania, and all 10 chutes had been seen to open. Well, this was not correct. My airplane had not gone down over the target in Romania, but our squadron lost 3 airplanes that day, so you can understand there was some confusion in all the melee of the battle as to which airplane was which. Anyhow, the idea that 10 chutes were seen to open probably gave them some comfort. Sometime later, my mother got word from the Yugoslavs via a devious radio route. She heard that I was safe with the guerrillas in Yugoslavia. And she wrote my father, and she said, How in the world did that kid get all the way from Romania into Yugoslavia? And she went on to say, but somehow he managed to do it, and think of the time he's having. I thought my mother was a very brave lady. Instead of poor Tom down behind enemy lines, she said, think of the time he's having.
Well, we thank you very much for talking to us, and we thank you for your service to your country. It's been an honor to meet you.
Thank you.